or new responsibilities. I also knew that the admirals could interpret this as Benfold's decline under my command. Still, I wanted to leave the Navy a legacy, and I was prepared never to be promoted again if that was the price I had to pay. My crew was going to be trained to make decisions. Few skills are more vital or would benefit them and their organizations more than that one, no matter where life took them. Nurture the freedom to fail. I worked hard to create a climate that encouraged quixotic pursuits and celebrated the freedom to fail. I never once reprimanded the sailor for attempting to solve a problem or reach a goal. I wanted my people to feel empowered so they could think autonomously. In the business community today, empowerment seems to be a four-letter word, but that's because it is misunderstood to mean letting your people do whatever they want. Empower your people and at the same time give them guidelines within which they are allowed to roam. I called it my line in the sand. I had to be in on any decision that could kill someone, injure someone, waste taxpayers' money, or damage the ship. But short of that, anyone on my ship should try to solve any problem that came up. Trying takes grit, builds skills, and breeds courage. Before we left for the Persian Gulf, a chief petty officer from the Australian Navy was assigned to Benfold for 6 months. He was a big rugby fan, a game my sailors had never played, but were happy to learn. He started a rugby clinic, and eventually we had a Benfold rugby team. We bought uniforms that made us the best-looking rugby team in the U.S. Navy. Of course, we were the only rugby team in the U.S. Navy. Unfortunately, we had to leave for the Gulf soon after the team was assembled, so their skills stagnated. As for actual talent, well, let's just say they weren't World Cup quality. When we finally pulled into port, the Benfold team challenged the International Rugby Team of Dubai. That took some gall. Dubai is full of expatriate Brits who take rugby very seriously. My sailors had a lot of spirit, but they had been at sea for 35 straight days, their stamina was shaky, and they lacked talent to begin with. So we got slaughtered, 77-5. It was pitiful. Worse, rugby is a very rough game with a high body count. Some of my star sailors were out there getting crunched, and I could just see them winding up with blown knees or broken legs, having to be flown back to the United States, leaving Benfold shorthanded. To my amazement, not one player was injured during the whole game. We had just one casualty, a young ensign who had flown in from stateside that very day and was sitting in the stands watching the game. As she looked away for a moment, the rugby ball sailed off the field and hit her left pinky, completely dislocating it. The pain was bad enough, but far worse that she was a concert pianist with plans for a music career. We rushed her to the American International Hospital in Dubai, where they put her finger back into place. Fortunately, she had a full recovery. How mysterious, though, that with all those bodies crashing into one another on the rugby field, the sole person injured was a concert pianist sitting in the stands. Someone up there really did love my crew. It was probably Edward Benfold. So we were slaughtered out there on the playing field. Who cares? I was thrilled that they had felt confident enough to take on the more experienced team. All managers should nurture the freedom to fail. Innovation knows no rank. In business terms, I viewed Benfold during its Persian Gulf deployment as a very productive company with one major customer, my boss, the three-star admiral in command of the Fifth Fleet. To dominate market share, our ship had to top all others in the categories most important to my customer. Given his relatively scarce resources, too few ships to handle constantly increasing U.S. commitments in the region, we focused on two ways we could help him the most and beat our competitors in the process. The first way was to achieve perfect marksmanship with Tomahawk missiles. Since we had practiced all the way across the Western Pacific, we aced this exercise, performing better than any other ship stationed in the Gulf. As a result, the three-star gave us more cruise missiles, more than double our original allocation, making us the biggest arsenal in the fleet. It was a distinct honor. Our second big opportunity for customer service involved the United Nations inspections of all ships entering and leaving Iraq. The admiral was responsible for making sure that no embargoed oil was smuggled out and no prohibited materials got in. It was and still is a difficult and tedious job. Navy ships boarded every ship traveling in the area, performed a thorough inspection, and sent the clean ones rapidly on their way. As in all transport business, time was money, so we had to avoid needless delays that might cost some company millions and inflame anti-U.S. sentiment in the region. At one point, when bad weather prevented our boarding, we were forced to make 5 Iraq-bound tankers wait at anchor for 3 days. When the weather improved, Commodore Duffy ordered us to clear the ships as quickly as possible, as he was taking heat for the delays. We had to pull them into a tight circle with Benfold in the center and sent out 2 search teams. We cleared the 5 ships, including all paperwork, in 2.5 hours. That was a record. The Commodore phoned me right away. "This can't be. Are you sure you thoroughly boarded those ships?" "Absolutely." "I'm coming over to observe you next time." "Aye, aye, sir, please do." I could afford to be serene, even smug. Thanks to a junior petty officer, fire controlman Derek Thomas, Benfold had found a shortcut. The boarding paperwork, required by the United Nations, was excruciatingly time-consuming and tedious, consisting of more than 100 questions. Worse, half of them had to be answered in radio conversations with the shipmasters, most of whom spoke very poor English. Compiling the entire written report could take days. After watching our officers suffer through this process in an earlier boarding, Petty Officer Thomas spoke up. "Why not create a database and speed this up? A lot of ships make this trip every week." I was on the bridge at the time. My officers looked at him and looked away. I would not have traded any of my officers for any others in the Navy. They were sharp. They were energetic. They knew their stuff. But as I said before, they were trained not to listen to the crew. Thomas was so junior they barely even acknowledged his existence. So I asked him to elaborate. "We have got electronic access to all these reports for the last year on every ship that's come in and gone out," he said. "Of the 100 items on the list of questions, 50 or 60 are routine information that never changes from trip to trip. I can create a database on the routine stuff so that even before you call a ship to stop, you will have 50% of the information you need up here on your laptop screen. You don't have to keep asking and translating over and over. The whole job, including the written reports, will take half the time." I told him to construct the database. It included more than 150 ships that had previously been boarded. Suddenly, we had half the report done before our search party went aboard, which explains how we cleared the 5 weather-delayed tankers and completed the written report in 2.5 hours. At our next boarding, Commodore Duffy came over on a helicopter. He was impressed by the efficiency of our search and seizure team, but he was astounded by the computerized database. "We have been boarding ships in the Gulf for the past 6 years," he said, "and no one ever came up with the idea to catalog all this information. Congratulations. Make me a copy right away." Our database was promptly distributed to every other ship performing boarding duties in the Gulf, and it's still being used. Obviously, the prime lesson of this story is that good ideas are where you find them, even on the forecastle. My officers were ready to discard a great idea because it came from a lowly enlisted man. Fortunately, I happened to overhear his recommendation. Every leader needs big ears and zero tolerance for stereotypes. But I will digress to point out 2 other lessons that may bear on your company. 1. With too few ships to inspect too many tankers, the admiral needed big results from limited resources. That's a problem many organizations share. Multitasking with the assets at your disposal is the only way to solve it. Benfold mastered the art of multitasking. 2. By getting very good at both inspecting tankers and shooting cruise missiles, Benfold achieved 2 coveted areas of expertise. The higher-ups were forever fighting over who got to use our services. That should be the goal of any business. Strive to offer high quality at low cost in versatile areas such that customers fight to place their orders. challenge your crew beyond its reach. Around the same time that stainless steel fasteners came into my life, I asked another sailor what he thought of our training program. "To be honest," he answered, "it's not all that good. You hand us the Navy training manual and make us order every item off the menu. You have never once asked the trainees what we feel we need. We are just doing training to put a check in the box." "Good point," I said. Inwardly, I could not help wondering how a chief bosun's mate or a marine drill instructor would react to this complaint. Ask recruits what they feel they need? You must be kidding. Recruits are forbidden to feel anything. They do what chiefs and sergeants are paid to tell them to do. Even so, I put together a team of trainers and trainees, and we completely revised our training program. Training is the lifeblood of the Navy. In any given year, you lose about one-third of your crew to transfers, discharges, injuries, or retirements. So the job of training never ends, and worse, you never get it quite right. In my 18-year career, I found Navy training generally inefficient and all too prone to incite discontent, if not outright loathing. If we ever did a return on investment study on training in the military, heads would roll. After a ship returns to its home port and completes a 9-week maintenance period, it begins the training needed to certify its readiness for the next deployment. After our Gulf service, Benfold began this process. It was soon after the Navy had revamped its training system to make it more responsive to today's demands. The new version hit the usual resistance to change. But on Benfold, we thought it was a quantum improvement, and with our trademark hubris, we considered it well worth trying to improve it even more. Of course, we had no inkling of how much effort lay ahead. The premise of the old training system was that all hands must be raised to the same skill level. But there was no flexibility in the group lessons. Even if 8 out of 10 people achieved perfection, the exercise had to be repeated until the 2 laggards caught up. You can imagine how all this repetition tended to vaporize time, not to mention interest and morale. Our solution was simple. We used technology to leverage our training time. We made our training tougher than anything we would ever see in combat. And we picked up the part of the new system that allowed targeted training for laggards. If 2 people were weak, they got remedial training apart from the other 8, which obviously saved time and presumably strengthened their confidence and skills. But as good as all this sounds in theory, in practice it was a mess. The problem was that the data recording process had not kept pace with technology. Records of which sailors completed which exercise and when were recorded with paper and pencils. Yes, you read that correctly. Paper and pencils. This antediluvian absurdity was sabotaging the new program. It snarled the scheduling, and ship after ship failed the final exam. The program's critics had badmouthed it, and the Commodore in charge, who strongly believed in it, found himself dangling from a yardarm. Believe it or not, and by now you probably believe it, no one had ever thought to computerize the records. So, we did just that. The petty officer who had created the Persian Gulf database, Derek Thomas, now made another one. Hit a key and you could see the training results, dates, scores, laggards, stars. The program even scheduled the training sessions. It was a phenomenal leap forward, ensuring snarl-free training and focusing on whomever needed special attention. Once that database was in place, we could use another powerful tool. The new technology embedded in ships allows captains to build their own training scenarios, tailored to all the possible places they can be expected to do battle. I programmed into our computer all of the possible forces that a rock could throw at us. Then I was able to build a simulated battle to test my crew's skill in combating those threats. I could tailor these battles to any expected threat anywhere in the world. In fact, I made the scrimmage tougher than anything we would ever see in real life. Some ships never took advantage of this breakthrough. When we arrived in San Diego, we faced a week-long assessment, a sort of mini-Olympics of Navy training. We had publicly stated that our goal was to validate the entire training program. This immodest assertion drove the old dinosaurs up the wall. They thought no one could be that good. Some even visited our ship during the assessment, all primed to see us eat our words. But we were ready. During the first week, assessors came aboard to evaluate the crew's level of training and assign us the final challenge that we would have to master before we could graduate, which Navy precedent said would be 6 months later. I'm sure you will forgive my pride when I tell you that Benfold aced the final graduation challenge at week one of the six-month process. We also got the highest score ever, higher than any ship that trained for the entire 6 months. How did we do it? The sailors themselves had redesigned the training program and made it more effective than the Navy had ever dreamed. I called the Commodore. "Sir," I said, straining to sound humble, "we just passed the training, and therefore don't have to go to sea for the 6 months of training." There was a pause while he picked up his jaw. "We're not set up to do that," he said finally. "You have to go to sea for 6 months." I gently negotiated with him. There's an art to managing your boss, and all bosses can be managed if you know what their triggers are. A universal trigger is saving money. So I explained that the Commodore could save bundles in fuel cost if he let us modify our training schedule and spend much less time at sea, since our readiness was already the best. He could use that fuel on the ships whose proficiency was not up to our level. He finally agreed to a 2-month training program. My crew had saved themselves 4 months of hard work. But when I proudly gave them the news, one sailor raised his hand. "This is free time, right?" "Sure. Why don't we go on port visits?" "No ships ever go on port visits during this training process," I said, "but I will ask." I called the Commodore. "No ships ever go on port visits during this training process," he told me. "Why not?" There was another one of his long pauses. "Well," he said, "I guess there's really no good reason why not." So for the next 2 months, we cruised the coast, making port visits at Puerto Vallarta and Cabo San Lucas in Mexico, San Francisco and Victoria, Canada. My sailors were in hog heaven, and they had earned it. Chapter 8. Take Calculated Risks. The U.S. Navy is no more fond of people who go out on a limb than as any other bureaucracy. In fact, taking a risk is seen as a danger to your career. But an organization that aims to stay alive and strong should make sure to praise and promote risk takers, even if they fail once in a while. Unfortunately, organizations all too often promote only those who have never made a mistake. Show me someone who has never made a mistake, and I will show you someone who is not doing anything to improve your organization. As I have said, I never took a reckless risk in my career. Each danger I ran was a calculated part of my campaign to create change without asking permission from higher authority. I took only the risks that I thought my boss would want me to take, risks I could defend within my job description and authority. For the most part, they produced beneficial results, and my boss got the credit for that, so he didn't object. Still, some risks are more dangerous than others. In general, bet on the people who think for themselves. When I took command of Benfold, I saw a crew of 310 men and women with untapped talent, untested spirit, and unlimited potential. I was determined to be the captain these sailors deserved. I wanted to send a loud message that would prove I was serious about making them partners, not peons. But I knew that words alone would have little impact. They had heard all the Navy slogans 1,000 times. Every admiral says our people come first, but few back those words with action. What I needed was a dramatic gesture. Fortunately, an opportunity came 4 days after I took command, when we faced the challenging job of refueling at sea. Navy ships carry at least half a tank of fuel at all times. Benfold's tanks hold almost 500,000 gallons. This keeps them ready for emergencies. If you're called on to help another vessel in distress, for example, you might have to travel great distances with no access to filling stations. When you get down to half a tank, you're supposed to refuel. And that job gets exciting when you do it at sea. Refueling at sea involves navigating alongside an oiler, a Navy tanker that carries some 8 million gallons of fuel. The ships stay parallel, moving ahead steadily at about 15 knots, 16 and a half miles an hour. After you maneuver your ship to a distance of 120 feet from the tanker, the tanker's crew sends over two cables, each carrying an 8-inch fuel hose. The cables are tensioned so that they will remain taut when the two ships separate or converge by a few yards, but the margin of error is thin. You always worry about breaking the lines by veering too far apart or dipping the hoses into the sea, ripping them away, if the ships get too close together. You hook the hoses to your tanks for the refill, and you can probably pump 200,000 gallons in a little over an hour and a half. Refueling at sea is great fun, but also very dangerous, especially in rough seas. The two ships are in danger of crashing into each other, risking structural damage as well as explosions. The job requires expert ship handling, and officers put their careers on the line every time they do it. It's crucial to practice often so that you become proficient, and also to make sure that when your junior officers become commanders, they won't be afraid of refueling their ships. By all accounts, Benfold had not refueled much at sea. Most of the previous refuelings had been done at the pier in port, which was not as dangerous. When I took command of Benfold, we had less than half a tank, so within days I ordered up a refueling at sea. I was now responsible for the ship and did not want to be caught unprepared. Only the combat systems officer, Lieutenant Kevin Hill, was thoroughly proficient with the maneuver. Though he was outstanding at it, no ship or company can rely on just one person for a critical procedure. That makes the whole ship hostage to a single individual who may get hurt or sick, leaving you in big trouble. In the current squeeze on business costs, many companies have cut back so much that they are only one deep in critical positions, leaving no margin for error. I saw this as a prescription for disaster. My goal was to cross-train in every critical area. Thus, when the day came, I didn't let the experienced officer do it. I wanted other people to start learning. I found myself on the bridge with a junior grade lieutenant, Casey Marshall, a great guy, always smiling, who was that watch's conning officer. The person who cons the ship orders the helmsman regarding its course and speed. I asked him if he had ever refueled at sea. He looked down at his feet and said, "No, sir." He was afraid I would think him incompetent. Far from it. The problem was that he had never been given the opportunity to learn. Next, I asked Lieutenant Jerry Olin, the officer of the deck, if he had ever run a refueling at sea. I got the same downward glance, the same, "No, sir." Olin actually thought I was going to relieve him. I looked at both these fine young officers and said, "Guess what? I have never done it before either. It's time the three of us learned how." They both broke into ear-to-ear grins. In truth, I had done it hundreds of times, though never on Benfold. I also had Kevin Hill on hand to coach and mentor the novices. While maneuvering alongside the tanker, Marshall was extremely tentative. The usual practice, I was told, was to wait to be directed in what to do. "I don't need parrots in my organization." Marshall kept asking me for permission to change rudder by a degree or add half a knot to our speed. "If all you give are orders, then all you will get are order takers." Since my goal was to create self-starters, I finally said, "Hey, Casey, it's your ship. Take responsibility for it. Don't ask permission. Do it." That was all he needed to hear. I stood by in case of trouble, but I became irrelevant. He took complete control and did a fantastic job. I was truly proud of him, and his confidence soared. I burst with pride when I think of how far KC progressed as a naval officer. The message raced through the ship. This captain doesn't want parrots. He wants people who think for themselves. That was my first opportunity to demonstrate a new style, and it paid off handsomely. Trusting a neophyte to perform this tricky maneuver was a powerful metaphor, as well as the reality of my way of leading. Refueling at sea became a symbol for the positive changes that lay ahead. But, in all honesty, I have to say I was terrified at the start of the refueling. After all, I had never been fully responsible for this maneuver. And here I was at 36 in charge of a billion-dollar asset. I was filled with self-doubt, and my heart was racing. I was nearly hyperventilating. I wondered what kind of image I was projecting. I called my XO, Lieutenant Commander Jeff Harley, and asked him if I appeared nervous. He said he could not tell, and I had no choice but to believe him. After we made our approach and settled in nicely alongside the tanker, I had a feeling of total relief. Then I started to feel almost giddy at how well Casey was doing. My own confidence started to soar, and I said to myself, "Hey, I can do this." 4 days into my tenure, I started to feel that Ben Folt had the potential to be great and do great things. Looking back, that refueling was when I started to believe in myself as a leader. Take a chance on a promising sailor. One of my first disciplinary cases on Ben Folt came just 3 weeks after I took command. A young sailor had stayed out late the night before we were to sail. He had forgotten to set his alarm, and we left without him. That's a serious offense, leaving a ship shorthanded in what might be a crisis, and it is obviously embarrassing to the captain. At the time, the young man could have gone either way, could have become either a good sailor or a chronic misfit. In the end, I took a big chance on him. My trust was a calculated risk that I hoped would pay off. First, we had to handle the offense. We called him at home in San Diego and told him to report to the Commodore, who had him flown out to the ship on a helicopter. I wanted to show the crew that, unlike many other COs, I wasn't going to let such cases fester for months before acting. So the minute the copter touched down, we announced his arrival on the public address system and told him to report for discipline. The rest of the crew noticed. He was very upfront and honest. He told me that he had stayed out too late, overslept, and was sorry. He took full responsibility for his actions. Personal accountability is a declining character trait in the United States today, so I took notice when he made no effort to shift the blame. I asked him how he thought I should penalize him. He recited the maximum penalty a captain can impose, fully expecting to be hit with it. I gave him about half of that, including 30 days restriction to the ship, 30 days extra duties, reduced rank, and half pay for 2 months. I also made him write a letter of apology to his shipmates, acknowledging that he had let them down, that if the ship had needed him in an emergency or in combat, he would not have been there to be counted on. Recognizing that had a big impact on him. To this day, he still feels bad, not that he missed the ship's departure, but that he let down his shipmates. The letter appeared in the Plan of the Day, a daily newsletter that everyone reads. The early signs were promising. He was doing all right. But while he was still on restriction, he made a special request to take a vacation so that he could fly home to see his mother. She was seriously ill, recovering from a major operation. The ship was scheduled for a 6-month deployment, and if he didn't see his mother during the 30 days he was restricted, he would have to wait 7 months. Every level of his chain of command turned him down. Since he was serving time for a transgression, the request went against every aspect of Navy discipline. I agonized over it. If I were to approve it, I might be sending a signal to the crew that I was soft. The risk I was weighing, very consciously, was whether the crew would believe I was serious about what I said, or would shrug me off as full of empty words. Finally, I approved his request. We gave him 7 days of leave and tacked the week on to his restriction when he came back. He went home, visited his mother, and came back a new man. He was determined never to let me or his shipmates down again. He felt he had been treated fairly and was going to repay us by becoming the best sailor there was. He trained himself to operate a very demanding watch station, monitoring the computer systems that handle secure transmission of enemy data between ships. This is one of the toughest positions for enlisted sailors in the Combat Information Center. He became the best at it, not only on the ship, but in the whole battle group. I was so impressed by his performance that I reinstated him to his third-class petty officer rank. When it was time for him to re-enlist, he said he would if we would send him to Air Traffic Controller School. That is an agonizing course. At least 50% flunk out of it. The entrance requirements include a clean disciplinary record in the minimum rank of second-class petty officer, and he was unqualified on both counts. But we went to bat for him and got an exemption. He graduated number one in his class and became the best air intercept controller I had seen. The sailor ultimately left the Navy and is working for the defense contractor that makes the software he had become so expert at using. He is working to solve its design flaws. He and I still keep in touch by email, and not long ago when I was in San Diego, we met for breakfast with his father, who wanted to thank me for what I had done for his son. That was a nice breakfast, and I left with a good feeling. It is gratifying to know you have had a positive impact on people's lives, and then see them go on to greater things. The Navy and the country will benefit immensely from his dedicated work for the defense contractor. If a rule doesn't make sense, break it. In most Persian Gulf ports, alcohol isn't available, so most U.S. sailors don't exactly rush ashore. Dubai is different. It's one of the Gulf's few wet ports, an attractive city of about 300,000 people in the United Arab Emirates, and my first visit there started beautifully. Commanding officers get a car and driver, and I toured the town like a visiting pasha, stopping to have a Foster's lager every now and then. In the meantime, 5 chartered buses were ferrying my crew to all the Liberty spots, and it pleased me to imagine how much fun they were having. I was wrong. When I met a sailor returning to our ship, I asked cheerily how he liked Dubai. He said he hated the place. So did his shipmates. This floored me. How could anyone hate Dubai? The problem was the transportation. He explained that the buses were 60-passenger rattle traps driven by demons who refused to stop when our sailors wanted to get off or on. Moreover, the Navy had ruled that sailors were restricted to using the buses to get around. Because of security concerns, they weren't even allowed to walk or take a taxi. This was not the kind of experience my crew deserved, so I immediately got rid of the buses and hired 20 10-passenger vans. That way, 10 sailors could check out their own chauffeured van and go anywhere they wanted in Dubai and its environs. However, hiring those vans violated Navy regulations. Many years ago, some well-meaning bean counter thought it would be cost-beneficial to require 60-passenger buses for sailors on Liberty. But I thought that cost had to be balanced with safety and the crew's experience. In my view, those behemoths were not only inconvenient, they were highly vulnerable targets. If one of them got hit by a terrorist, it might kill 60 sailors, whereas attacking one of my vans would cause 10 casualties at worst. This was not just a rationalization. My world had been rocked when terrorists blew up the Khobar Towers military complex in Saudi Arabia in the summer of 1996, killing 19 airmen. I was with Secretary Perry at the time, and we flew to Riyadh to inspect the damage. We stood in the huge crater where the bomb had gone off. We saw the dormitory room where the force of the blast blew an airman into the ceiling and left an indented print of his body. We never discussed it, but it may have been William Perry's worst day as U.S. Secretary of Defense. I resolved then and there never to let that happen to anyone whose life had been entrusted to me. Against regulations or not, the vans were the right thing to do. Overnight, my crew started enjoying Dubai, and I slept better knowing they were safer than before. I even assigned 4 people, 2 officers and 2 chief petty officers, to full-time duty as fund coordinators, responsible for making sure that my sailors had the best possible shore liberties. For example, they spotted an advertisement in the Khaleej Times, the local newspaper, for an upcoming concert by the touring U.S. rapper Coolio. 50 of our sailors went to the show, as well as 50 more from another ship, USS O'Bannon. Every day those minivans bopped around Dubai, taking my crew sand skiing in the desert, swimming in the mountain lakes, to a shopping mall, the theater, beach clubs, and restaurants. The town even had a Mexican eatery. Who could dislike Dubai? The sailors from every other U.S. ship. They were still bouncing around in the big buses, hating every minute. Their displeasure eventually percolated up to Vice Admiral Tom Fargo, the 3-star commanding the 5th Fleet. Like me, Fargo had assumed that Dubai was a great liberty town. It was an issue of class and rank. Commanding officers and admirals in their chauffeured sedans loved Dubai. Enlisted people could not wait to leave. Not long after we canned our rattle traps, Fargo was being driven through town with his executive assistant, ruefully wondering about the grumbling he had heard from sailors on other ships. His security officer driver overheard him and asked permission to speak. The driver then gave the admiral an earful about the Benfold experience. Fargo was fascinated and immediately ordered his aide to have me churn out a written report of everything we had done. Not knowing whether I would be reprimanded or cheered, I decided to fess up and wrote a 5-page summary of how Benfold transformed Persian Gulf duty from onerous into a great trip. I described our improvised tools, music videos, light shows, and all the details of our Dubai caper, including the liberties I had taken with those illegal vans. Finally, I asked his help in getting the regulations changed. Fargo came through. He sent my 5-page manifesto to every ship in the Persian Gulf. I later heard that on the aircraft carrier Nimitz, the commanding officer met with all his senior people to decide how they could scale up our techniques for their sailors. Here I was, the most junior commanding officer in the Persian Gulf, and everyone was borrowing from our playbook. By the way, Tom Fargo is now a 4-star admiral in charge of the entire Pacific Fleet, and it's okay for Navy ships to hire vans instead of buses. If a rule does make sense, break it carefully. At the beginning of August of that year, 2 weeks before we were set to depart from San Diego, I told Master Chief Sheeler to load 100 cases of beer on the ship and lock them up. He looked alarmed, as if he might be dealing with a closet loony. In fact, he gave me the 100-yard stare, totally dazed. Drinking alcohol is absolutely forbidden on Navy ships, and for good reason. Nautical lore bristles with stories of mutinies, shipwrecks, and other disasters fueled by alcohol. "Captain," he said, "what are you going to do with 100 cases of beer?" "I haven't a clue," I answered, "but when the opportunity presents itself, I don't want to be unprepared. And by the way, please get premium beer. I don't want my crew drinking anything substandard." It was obvious from his expression that he wasn't exactly with the program. A week later, I asked him where the beer was, and he said the chiefs hadn't ordered it yet. "Why not?" "Well, sir, we just think it's a bad idea to load beer. We think the crew will get into trouble." As a Pentagon alumnus, I know slow rolling when I see it, and I was being slow rolled. When people don't agree with you, they slow their actions till you are past the drop-dead date. "Master Chief," I said calmly, "I want you to load 100 cases of beer on my ship." 3 days later, he came back with the executive officer, and both of them tried to change my mind. "You guys don't understand," I said. "I told you I want beer on this ship." "There's no way we can talk you out of it?" "No way whatsoever." In short order, a huge 18-wheeler beer truck backed down the pier, and we proceeded to load 100 cases of premium beer. We put them under lock and key, and I had the key. No one could figure out when, if ever, we might actually drink the stuff. But you can't go into a combat zone without proper gear. That was the Benfold motto, always be prepared. By December 30th, 1997, we had completed almost our entire 100-day Gulf tour and still hadn't touched the beer. I was beginning to think the opportunity would never come. The very next day, New Year's Eve, Saddam Hussein threw another fit. Benfold was ordered to leave Bahrain and get into position to fire our Tomahawk missiles at Iraq, if ordered. What upset everyone on board, including me, was that all the other ships were staying in Bahrain, where their crews could celebrate New Year's Eve at the Navy base. In effect, they were getting a prize for being less proficient with their cruise missiles than we were. Fortunately, the crisis passed, and while we were standing by at sea on the afternoon of December 31st, a heavy storm doused Bahrain with 2 inches of rain. Bahrain, alas, has no sewers. 2 inches of not very clean water flooded the entire city. It knocked out the power plant and closed the Navy base. As a result, all sailors were restricted to their ships on New Year's Eve with no alcohol. Benfold was told to return to port if we wished. Instead, I set course for anchorage outside Bahrain and told my supply officer to chill the beer. He looked pained and perplexed. So did Master Chief Sheeler, who said, "Sir, I'd like to try and talk you out of serving beer on the ship." "Master Chief," I answered, "I have no intention of serving beer on this ship." "What are you cooling it down for?" "We're going to have a cookout and drink beer, but not on the ship." As we approached the anchorage, we were met by a huge barge, probably 50 feet wide and 300 feet long. I had arranged with our husbanding agent to have it towed there. We lowered our ladder to the barge and presto, we had, at least in my interpretation of the regulations, access to a non-ship party space. That night, while all the other sailors in the area spent a bone-dry New Year's Eve restricted to their ships, my people had a well-earned blast on our party barge where the beer flowed, the cookout sizzled, the stereo boomed, and we all cheered the arrival of 1998. The one thing we didn't have was fireworks. In hindsight, we could have rustled up a pretty decent pyrotechnic show with all the firepower we had on that ship. Delighted to celebrate with friends in a unique way to Benfold, a way that honored their hard work, many sailors said it was the best New Year's Eve party they had ever attended. They were with not just shipmates, but comrades. That's exactly how their captain felt, too. Chapter 9. Go Beyond Standard Procedure. In the Navy, as in business, SOP, Standard Operating Procedure, tends to rule. After all, it's standard, safe, proven, effective. You will seldom get in trouble for following standard operating procedure. On the other hand, you will rarely get outstanding results. And, all too often, SOP is a sop. It distracts people from what's really important. In my time in the Navy, we often let ourselves get deflected from our real priorities by petty bureaucratic inspections or by the need to put on a good show for a visiting VIP. At times, we seemed most concerned about getting the captain promoted to admiral. All these efforts detracted from our bottom line goal, combat readiness. Innovation and progress are achieved only by those who venture beyond standard operating procedure. You have to think imaginatively, but realistically, about what may lie ahead and prepare to meet it. You have to look for new ways to handle old tasks and fresh approaches to new problems. As my friends at NASA would say, you have to push the envelope. And it's never easy. Keep your priorities in focus. I first learned this lesson in the Persian Gulf at 0430 on August 2nd, 1990, courtesy of Saddam Hussein. It was a moment of truth in my life. A defining event that has charted my course ever since. At the time, I was a 29-year-old combat systems officer on USS England, an old cruiser equipped with long-range guided missiles to shoot down incoming aircraft. This was my fourth post since graduating from the Naval Academy in 1982, and I was still learning. The commanding officer of England, who was the aristocratic son of a diplomat, was difficult to work for. The XO was nearing retirement. I wasn't learning a great deal from either of them. Still, I did my best to master my complex job. Peacetime naval deployment schedules get planned years in advance, so it had been decided back in 1988 that we would reach the Persian Gulf on August 2, 1990, which turned out to be the day Saddam invaded Kuwait. Ironically, the United States was drawing down its forces in the area at that time. We had no Army or Air Force personnel stationed in the region, and only 5 warships in the Gulf, 4 small frigates, and the England, with no air cover. At 0430, the general quarters alarm sounded on board. I leaped out of bed, rushed to my post, still wiping the sleep from my eyes, looked at the radar screen, and saw 21 fighter jets coming right at us. The first thought that flashed through my mind was, "Holy shit." The second was, "My will is up to date, and my life insurance is paid up." Then, the commanding officer asked me what I was going to do. I looked at him in total disbelief. I had been waiting for him to tell me what to do. I took a deep breath and told him that the fighters were about 120 miles away, and our missiles had a maximum range of about 115 miles. I was going to open fire when the jets were at 80 miles. There was just one problem. We still didn't know whose jets they were. They were coming at us from the vicinity of Iraq, and since we didn't have any allies in that area, we could only assume they were hostile. To call the ensuing minutes tense would be a great understatement. The jets kept getting closer and closer. At 82 miles, just as I was getting ready to launch the first missile salvo, they made a sudden right turn into Saudi Arabia. I'm sure my sigh of relief was heard down in the engine room. Hours later, Navy intelligence informed us that it had been the fleeing Kuwaiti Air Force. We came very close to a major fiasco because we didn't have the relevant information when we needed it. The weeks that followed were anxious ones for us. There were very few U.S. or allied forces in the Gulf, and we were vulnerable to attack from Saddam. Then help started arriving. An aircraft carrier came first, then jet fighters and army units. We all know the final outcome. We won Operation Desert Storm because we used overwhelming force. But at the start, USS England was pretty much alone. Had Saddam come after us, the result would have been grim. Those early days were so tense that after standing watch for 6 hours, I'd be too keyed up to sleep or even rest. During those long, worrisome hours, I had a lot of time to think about how unprepared England truly was for battle. The ship was not as combat ready as it should have been. The officers could have done much more to make it so. Instead, we had spent too much time and effort putting on the obligatory tour for the visiting admiral. It was time that provided no value to the bottom line of combat readiness. I made a solemn pledge to myself that if I ever had the opportunity to captain a ship, I would not flunk the challenge. I would focus on combat readiness, because without it, people could die. I never wanted one of my sailors to go home in a body bag because I had failed as a leader. If we had taken casualties on that fateful day, I would have gone to my grave knowing that I hadn't done my best to prepare England for battle. Even as a junior officer, I could have insisted on training much harder and created better incentives for the crew to perform. It was a grave failure of leadership. At 0430 that morning, as I watched those jets racing toward us, I had a wake-up call. I made a decision that from that day forward, any ship under my command would be battle-ready and manned by the most highly prepared, motivated, and respected sailors in the Navy. And there would be no distractions. We would constantly plan for what-if situations. What if an enemy fighter was traveling in a commercial air route and suddenly veered toward us, threatening to attack? What if a terrorist boat tried to attack us in port? What if we had a major fire on the ship? In battle, our initial reactions can often be the difference between success and failure, life and death. We also need to apply the successes and mistakes of others to our own situation and learn from them. If you prepare for the most challenging scenarios, chances are good that you'll be much better prepared for the unforeseen. Stay ahead of the competition. A little forward planning can give you an enormous advantage. For example, Benfold and two other ships, Steatham and Lake Champlain, were scheduled to perform an important exercise at sea. It called for us to line up in a column and prove our marksmanship by shooting down a simulated missile. A drone, with our own missiles. Launched from a plane, the drone presents a very small target. Each ship had to determine where the target was coming from, then fire two missiles to knock it out before it destroyed us. Our missiles travel at about 3,600 miles per hour. These drones travel at about 500 miles per hour and are so expensive and carry such sophisticated test equipment that actually hitting one is rare. Sensors tell the drone controllers when a ship's missile is about to impact, so at the very last second, they maneuver it out of the way. The test equipment determines whether the ship would have scored a hit. Typically, you just show up on the day of a missile shoot, perform the task, and sail away. But we wanted to excel, and in this case, the feeling went deeper than usual. Steatham was a sister ship, a carbon copy of Benfold that was built at the same time in the same Mississippi shipyard. And both crews had a strong case of sibling rivalry. In Lake Champlain, an Aegis cruiser had become my arch rival. I was a three-striper and the most junior commander in the Pacific Fleet. Lake Champlain's four-stripe captain was the most senior. It was natural then to want to outgun them in friendly competition. Time after time, Benfold outperformed Lake Champlain. Actually, I didn't consider it rivalry. I didn't have any rivals. I was in competition only with myself, to have the best ship we possibly could. Inevitably, however, other commanders chafed when Benfold kept topping them, and whether I wanted it or not, rivalries emerged. To be honest, I enjoyed winning, and I wasn't sensitive enough to avoid gloating, but I will return to discuss that further. In this particular competition, we knew what winning would take. The drone knew precisely what our radar was picking up and could respond instantly. Realizing that the odds were against us in this challenge, and wanting to maximize a business opportunity, we started planning for the exercise 3 months in advance. Lake Champlain's captain was in charge of the shootout, but he and his officers did little planning until the last minute. When they finally focused, it was too late for the crew to do a good job. By contrast, we were so organized that we gave ourselves a break and scheduled a port visit in San Francisco 5 days before the event. Just as we pulled into San Francisco, I received an order from Lake Champlain's CO to turn around and rush south for a rehearsal off San Diego. I responded that we were on a port visit and were so well prepared for the shoot that we didn't need to rehearse. He reminded me that he was the senior commanding officer, and if I didn't attend the rehearsal, he would ban us from the shoot, which would ruin Benfold's readiness rating. I took the liberty of forwarding that missive without comment to the three-star admiral's chief of staff in San Diego, Captain Ed Hebert. He promptly sent a message back to the CO of Lake Champlain with copies to everyone else, saying that Benfold was free to do whatever it wished about the rehearsal. In the culture of the Navy, it was a pretty big deal to cast aside a senior officer's preference in favor of a junior officer's. I thought that Lake Champlain's CO must have been a bit embarrassed, so I decided to do the right thing and show up for the rehearsal anyway. We cut short our San Francisco visit by 12 hours and raced Benfold south at 30 knots to take part in the practice. We headed out of San Francisco into a spectacular sunset, with the crew manning the rails to enjoy it. In the bay's tricky currents, it might have been more prudent to leave by daylight, but again, I was moving outside of standard procedure. My business was a 24/7 operation, and we needed to navigate proficiently at night. That sunset transit was a thoroughly memorable event. The next day, a plane stood in for the drone, and we practiced the communication procedures without actually shooting. Benfold was the first ship to detect the aircraft, and the first to get out all the reports. Expecting my Lake Champlain colleague to resent losing the first round to Benfold, I figured that during the actual exercise, he would order his crew to fire the first shot, which I predicted the drone was programmed to evade. In other words, shooting first would be a good way to miss the target and lose the award for competently defending your ship against incoming missiles. "Don't be the first to shoot," I told my people. "Accuracy is more important. The only thing anyone will remember tomorrow is who hit the target, not who shot first. Just stay cool and make sure that both our shots are bullseyes." As I predicted, Lake Champlain shot off a missile as soon as it detected the target, but the drone immediately evaded. Steatham shot both its missiles, both missed, before Benfold shot its first. Lake Champlain never got off its second missile. Benfold scored two direct hits. One ship's going to do better than the other. The point is to be sure to take responsibility as the CO, because how well the crew is prepared and how well it performs typically is a reflection of how well the CO leads. Push the envelope for innovation. On one of my trips out of the Pentagon with Secretary Perry, we visited a ship that had rigged a satellite TV system. Those sailors watched world news on CNN, and that ship was actually one of the best I had ever seen. When we boarded another ship without TV, the contrast was striking. The first crew knew about the events that might affect their lives, while the other ship was completely oblivious and could not have cared less. I realized firsthand the power of information. Those that have it prosper, those that don't wither. Satellite TV was available only on carriers at the time, which meant just 12 of the Navy's 300 ships. Perry told me to write a memo to the Secretary of the Navy, directing him to put satellite TV on these ships. I wrote the memo, but before sending it, I decided to talk to a senior officer in the Navy's budget office to tip him off that this was coming and that they had better start budgeting for it. He said, "Mike, you can have the Secretary of Defense sign that memo, but there's no money in the budget for it. It isn't on our list of priorities, and it is never going to happen. I guarantee you we're going to wait you out on this one, and nothing is ever going to come of it." I was dejected. Perry signed the memo, and I sent it to the Secretary of the Navy. But I knew he had very little time left in office, and nothing would happen. I stopped thinking about it. It was a lost cause. Flash forward. Benfold had just arrived in the Persian Gulf. One of my officers came back from the 5th Fleet's headquarters, where he had heard about a new program to fit out 3 ships to receive satellite TV at sea. Lo and behold, the Navy Secretary had actually held the Admiral's feet to the fire. I almost fell out of my chair. I had the officer in charge of our electronic equipment call the Pentagon and find out which 3 ships were destined to get this equipment. Benfold was not one of them. I called the Navy commander who was handling the program and explained who I was. When she found out I had written the memo, Benfold became number 1 on the list of ships to get the equipment. The next day, our satellite TV receivers were express shipped to us in the Persian Gulf, and my crew spent the next 2 weeks figuring out how to install them. When they were done, Benfold was the only ship in the Gulf with satellite TV except for the 2 carriers. We could get news, sports, even sitcoms. The crew felt honored. We used to tape record football playoffs, and the other ships would send over their helicopters to pick up a copy. If we had stopped at standard operating procedure, had I not called the Navy commander in charge of the program, we would not have gotten the TV. But it was the right thing to do to fight for it, just as it was right for Perry to push for it in the first place. That equipment is now being installed on every ship in the Navy, and it is doing wonders for the morale, not to mention performance, of ships on long sea duty. Volunteering benefits everyone. In my interviews with the crew, I got feedback in ways I never imagined. After we implemented the lower decks ideas on how to improve the way we did business, the ship's energy began heating up. Performance leaped, along with morale and reenlistments. I was beginning to feel very good about myself as a leader. My hubris was promptly punctured. One day I asked a 19-year-old sailor how he liked Benfold. He said he hated the ship and was getting out of the Navy as soon as possible. That crushed me. How could anyone hate my ship? But I recovered. I told him he was a great electronics technician, and when he got out of the Navy, I would help him get a job in the electronics industry. He said he hated electronics and would have nothing to do with it in civilian life. I asked what he did want to do, and he said he wanted to be a social worker. In my ignorance, I actually chuckled and informed him that social workers don't make any money. I said I could get him a job paying $60,000 to $80,000 a year. All we had to do was stick with electronics, the wave of the future. I must have sounded like the pompous businessman in the movie classic The Graduate, who gives young Dustin Hoffman the secret password to fame and fortune, plastics. I will never forget that teenage sailor's response. He said he had spent his whole life in and out of foster homes. He wanted to help make sure that what happened to him did not happen to other children. I felt as small as a man could. I had just had my core values calibrated by someone half my age. I was really shaken by this experience and spent about a week sitting in my bridge wing chair staring at the sea. The obvious answer finally hit me. I should use my future social worker's talents right now. I called him to come up and told him that his next mission was to find a local elementary school in San Diego that we could adopt. When we pulled back into port, he spent a week searching for the right school. When he found that, I told him to round up as many shipmates as he could and find out what the school needed. He gathered 40 of his shipmates, kids on the lowest rung of the economic ladder, and established a relationship with the school, painting the building for